One issue related to that is the dwarfs fall on a pretty tight mass metallicity relationship, so it really is hard to, you know, you got to get things from the right mass range, as you said, if you want.
Okay, good. So we will continue with our regularly scheduled broadcast now. The semester grows short. Next week is it. I will try to work in some sort of review on Tuesday. When your homework is due, we'll have an exam. So, any questions before we launch into it? Okay, so today I want to finish off what we were talking about with WIMP dark matter last time, in particular detection methods, and then try to give a brief overview of MOND. Lots of people like criticize MOND, but you need to actually know what you're talking about to do that. Shockingly few people who do make those criticisms know what they're talking about. Okay, so we had talked a bit about indirect detection of WIMPs. We'd gotten up to gamma rays, and we were not seeing them so far in dwarf spheroidals or nearby. Another indication that there may have been detection of WIMPs indirectly was through the cosmic ray counts, the cosmic ray excess famously reported by Pamela in 2008. And so basically, if you send up a satellite that counts the number of cosmic rays that go whizzing through, then one traditionally finds a declining fraction of positrons as a function of energy. So this is the incoming energy of the cosmic ray, and those were expected to go down according to that line. And they did initially, and then they popped up. So there's an excess of positrons, anti-electrons. And this was confirmed by Fermi and gamma ray fluxes from the 511 keV line, where electrons and positrons annihilate too. So there is an excess. The problem is an excess over what? You see, this line doesn't fit anything, right? That was the expectation, and obviously the expectation was wrong at low energies as well as high energies, right? So one needs to stand back and ask what this does, and this is the sort of the predicted spectrum from Galprov, which is a complicated model because the Milky Way acts as a big particle accelerator, a big cyclotron. There's a magnetic field, not uniformly, but magnetic fields threaded throughout the interstellar gas of the Milky Way, and it basically acts as a big particle accelerator. That's how some of these things get such high energies. But it also, because the field isn't smooth, it scatters. So cosmic rays end up doing a sort of a random walk if they do not have a particularly big mean free path. So a parsec maybe, that's a long ways to you and me, but it's not the whole galaxy. Right? So when these things get here, even if you can keep track of where they come from, it doesn't relate to their sources the way light does. Right? If you go out and look at a star, the light has traveled unimpeded from that direction, unless there's a gravitational lens in the way. With cosmic rays, they've been scattered all over the place before they get here, and that's what that was trying to model, not too successfully. Nonetheless, what is weird is that you get this upturn, and so people thought, aha, there's a new source of cosmic rays, and that could follow from the decay of WIMP dark matter. So the notion was, as we talked about the diagram last time, we have two WIMPs, whatever dark matter coming in, it happens here, and you get decay particles and products coming out, and maybe those were electron-positron pairs. Now that can't happen directly, because these things are tiny masses. These things are big masses, right? So you need something that a lot of things happen in here. You conserve energy, you need a lot of these things going out. So on the one hand, this would be a good way of making a lot of electrons and positrons. The hard thing is having enough magic happen in there that you get down to this. Right? So things usually, they can decay directly to photons, but otherwise they have to decay example of how weird the dark matter physics can get, one of the ideas for what went on in here was that there is a new force in the dark sector, like we talked about the fundamental forces, electromagnetism, all that. So there's some new dark energy carrier called, by some people, dark photon. They say carry energy with photons too. Worst name ever, right? Dark photon, oxymoron. But that's the names they've got. The WNZ bosons, they don't have to be massless. So the idea was that, you know, the mass of dark matter particle is nominally expected to be of order 100 GeV plus a couple or minus a couple of orders of magnitude. And the mass of this force carrier would have to be just less than about 1 GeV. Why?
What weighs 1 GeV that we know about?
Protons! Right, so if you make this even as big as 2 GeV, then this process is going to give you protons, antiprotons. But if you make this just a little bit less than what a proton weighs, then the only thing left for it to do after, you know, first it decays to these, and then these things decay to electrons. Notice this is a violation of Occam's razor, right? We're inventing a new force, not just dark matter, we're inventing a new force in the dark sector, and we're giving a very fine-tuned value to the mass of the force carrier. So, you gotta watch what people are doing. It's one reason I wanted to develop this course. This is the sort of excess, rephrased, it's basically the positron fraction again. This is some sort of nominal expectation that is not very well, it's not fundamental. So people will say, oh, there's an excess. Excess over what? The question is, how do you actually fit the data? It turns out that, well, as a matter of principle, I would say before you interpret some signal as being due to dark matter, you must first exclude the astrophysical sources, which I think I've set down here, and we've lost the angle on our projector. So what astrophysical sources can produce these kind of cosmic rays? Turns out that pulsars are actually pretty good at that. Right? In fact, so if you talk to people who call themselves astroparticle physicists and get very excited every time they see a bump in the dark, this is dark matter. They'll say this is perfectly naturally explained by dark matter. If you go and talk to high energy astrophysicists who actually work on neutron stars and things, they'll say, that's stupid, because pulsars do this. And so that's the difference between those fields, right? They're not really talking to each other. It turns out that this also did not follow as naturally from this decay process as we thought. When you go through the numbers, the density of dark matter locally is too low to give us this many cosmic rays. You need a boost factor of at least a factor of 100. So there was some talk about Rutherford boosting, and maybe we lived really near to one of these subhalos happened to be passing by and enhance density. So people turn the crank on what the number density of subhalos is, large, but the chance that there's one here now, small. So this was all the rage, you know, 2008, 2009. You won't hear it again until we get another. Finally, I wanted to, about WIMPs, I wanted to cover the direct experimental detections. This is really the LHC we talked about last time and these indirect detection methods. Those are cool ideas, but we've put all our eggs really in this basket as far as detecting WIMPs. Many, many direct detection experiments. And this is now running the clock instead of from top to bottom as I drew it. Is now running the interaction this way. You have a WIMP come in and interact with some standard model particle and scatter off of it.
into construction of these experiments, that standard model particle is the nucleus of some heavy atom like xenon or germanium. And the reason for that choice is the mass of the wimp, basically looking for the signature of elastic scattering. And so that's maximized when you have roughly equal mass things.
So those things have masses of order that, including moles and protons and neutrons.
And so you imagine some big detector. Germanium's illustrated here. This was the first thing people tried. Those have now been superseded largely by xenon detectors for technical reasons. But the idea is the same in both cases. This picture that I've been teaching you is true. There are gazillions of wimps streaming through, the Earth all the time. So just like for a neutrino detector, the program is to make a really big detector. Most of the wimps are weakly interacting, so they don't interact, but there is some cross-section for of the weak interaction to mediate a collision between the wimp and the nucleus. So there are zillions of wimps streaming through the detector, and one in a zillion might actually bounce off the nucleus. So that's the signal that you're looking for, and what it'll look like is the deposit of energy from nowhere. Right? The wimp itself doesn't get captured and dissected on the table like in the X-Files. It just bumps into a nucleus and goes on out of the detector, but the nucleus has picked up some of that energy in the scattering. In the germanium detectors, the germanium is in a solid lattice, so you make a pure crystal of germanium. You have to get it really, really pure, so it's just a nice lattice. And then the wimp comes along and plucks one of the nuclei in the lattice, and the whole lattice vibrates. It introduces a phonon into that lattice, and you can measure the phonon energy. So, what's the obvious problem with building such a detector? There are lots of obvious ones. Anything that bumps into it will create phonons. Right? So you have to shield your detector from everything that might set it off. First thing that'll set it off is thermal energy, right? If it's warm, then it's just naturally jiggling. So you have to freeze it to absolute zero. That's what they're doing here. In fact, they usually put the detector inside a cryostat that itself is inside a cryostat. And they can get down to something like 0.4 Kelvin, meaning super close to absolute zero. So, remove all the thermal energy. But then you also have to shield it from natural radioactivity, right? There's just stuff that's going to look like a wimp to the detector that's just from naturally occurring radioactive decay. That level is not zero. Cosmic rays coming from the sky will do it. So you bury it in a deep underground lab and you put all sorts of lead and water and things around it to keep things out. You do have to have some physical connection to monitor this. So this is an example of the more modern xenon detectors. The xenon is a really clever way of doing it, because the xenon is largely self-shielding, if you can get everything else out. And that's good against, because even after you've gone underground, deep into the mine, put it behind a block of lead to protect it from the natural radioactivity in the mine, put it in water to protect it from anything else, you still have to have photomultiplier tubes to watch for the event. Those are built with materials that are naturally radioactive. But you have a much better control and handle on what those are, and so it turns out that xenon will prevent the propagation of events from the edges due to radioactivity in the detectors. So basically what you have to do is isolate a big bulk volume of xenon, and then you only look for events that are in the center of that volume. If you're an investor in raw materials, now is probably a good time to buy xenon futures, because the current generation is already using a significant fraction of the world's supply of xenon. And the next generation will
basically use it all. the idea, the physics is that you have some external source comes in, a WIMP presumably, bumps into your xenon nucleus, it scatters off, that produces two signals in a xenon detector. One is that it ionizes, well, it creates an initial flash that you see with the phototubes. It also ionizes the xenon, which releases from electrons. You put an electric field in here, so the electrons drift up, and then you have a charge detector at the edge, too. So you first see the first signal, the flash, and then you see a second signal from the ionized electrons. And you can figure out where in the detector this happened because you control the electric field, control the audio and video, and so you can just measure the time it takes between where you see that flash of light and when the electrons hit your detector, and so that drift time tells you where this happened, and that way you can screen out events that are too close to the edge of the detector. Really brilliant technology, and there's many steps that have gone into there, a lot of them done by our colleagues in physics across the quad. It just, you know, you sort of had to invent technologies along the way to do this, right? To even get close to the cryogenic temperatures needed is itself kind of a small miracle of engineering. So you do all this, and you end up with a plot like that, and your head explodes. Okay, so what are we plotting here? This is the WIMP detection. It plots the cross section with which the WIMP interacts with the nucleus. So basically this is the chance that WIMP actually scatters against a nucleus. And so the lower that is, the less likely that you are to detect an event. The amount of energy the WIMP imparts to the nucleus depends on the mass of the nucleus and the mass of the WIMP, i.e. how close to the assumption of elastic scattering are we. And so each detector type has a minimum that corresponds to the mass of the nucleus they're using, the amount of xenon, argon, germanium, etc. And you can see from all these different lines that there are lots and lots of different experiments going on. The solid lines are actual limits at the time that this plot was made, so everything above that line is excluded, and that includes some previous claims of detections. Okay, so this is an important enough result that one would really like to see many of these experiments see the same signal and agree that they see the same signal. So Dalma made a famous claim that nobody else believes because nobody else detected the same thing. And there are theoretical ways that you can sort of, well, maybe Dalma's sensitive to it because of inelastic cross-section, and theorists love to play those games. But basically, there is no convincing detection yet. And there are ambitious experiments that will take you down here. LZ is the experiment that we'll use along the xenon 1 ton, all of the xenon that we can actually trap from the whole Earth. Yeah?
Is the yellow section the lower limit?
So down here is where you will for sure start detecting weakly interacting particles.
Oh, okay.
But not WIMPs, neutrinos. We know neutrinos are weakly interacting particles. We know they're all through space, and many of them come from the sun. It's just that they're so low mass that they don't make as big a signal in these things. But if you keep making them sensitive enough, then eventually the neutrinos will start doing it. So these neutrinos are from specific reactions that we know are going on in the sun as it fuses hydrogen to helium. And they better be right at this point, right? I mean, the solar neutrino problem is what gives us neutrino oscillations in the first place. But we know all those things pretty well at this point, so you will see them there. As you go further up, you get some contribution from atmospheric neutrinos. What does that mean? Leaving neutrinos. It's another bad name. That's from cosmic rays hitting the top of the atmosphere, and then as part of the spallation products, you get some neutrinos. Okay, so you should have a neutrino shower, and that'll go through the crust of the Earth and down into your mind just as easily as LIMS will. There's also the diffuse supernova background. Basically, every supernova that ever went off produced a big load of neutrinos. And if you integrate that up, there's actually some finite amount of background neutrinos you expect from all those supernova incidents. Now that rate is somewhat uncertain, but you'll bump into it somewhere down here. So that is the end game for these experiments. If they push the limits down this far and not detect anything, they've reached the point where they can't really expect to detect anything, because even if it's there, they won't be able to tell the difference between a WIMP and a neutrino.
If people have already been able to detect neutrinos from like sun, ice cube, then how come we can't already get to those low limits? Like, I guess it seems like neutrinos are more difficult to detect than WIMPs, at least from this.
It's a different construction of the experiment, right? So here you're looking specifically for the elastic scattering of something massive, whereas things like Ice Cube that were designed to look for neutrinos would have that mass scale in mind. So you can see these things, they all have this sharp decline right here. It's very hard for these things to probe low masses, which is sort of by construction. Particle physics that I spared you from is that you can actually, within the context of the WIMP miracle that we did talk about, you can set a lower limit on the WIMP mass. That argument doesn't work if the mass is too low, and that limit is around 2 GeV. And so when they designed these experiments, they were not worried about going there. So it's basically the mass range. There's also an extra trick, because you know neutrinos exist, you can look for nuclear reactions that involve them. And so the original deep underground mine experiment that pointed out the solar neutrino problem in the first place used the reaction of neutrinos between chlorine and argon. So I think it's argon 39 decays into chlorine. Into neutrino. So what they did was they looked for the reverse process, just had a big tank of cleaning fluid with a lot of chlorine in it, and they, you know, worked out how they could count the number of chlorine nuclei really, really well. And if a neutrino came by and turned one of those into an argon atom, then it was lost from the track, and they could do the budget. And that was what gave the original, not just the original neutrino detection, but was already good enough to tell you had a solar neutrino. Factor a few off, but that's a specific reaction. This is just a general scattering, right? So they were taking advantage of knowing something more about the neutrinos. As I hope is clear at this point, we really don't know anything about the WIMPs other than what we've made up, literally hypothesized. Okay, so where are we actually now? An important thing in science is to set a prior. What do you actually predict? And if we follow the WIMP miracle that I talked about, there was actually, this is sort of the natural cross-section. That was this pink area, same diagram here, cross-section against mass. This pink area was the original prediction. WIMPs were hypothesized. That was excluded over 20 years ago. So the theorists got a hold of this and said, oh, did we say 10 to the minus 39? We said we meant 10 to the minus 44. That's what we mean. And this is, it is the Majorana seesaw mechanism that is invoked to make that change. So the WIMP miracle works if you have a cross-section up like that. That's not consistent with data, so there is another sort of attractor in space that's down here. That was not the original prediction. So at the time this plot was made, the best predictions were around here, 2008, Prada et al. And I remember asking at the time, you know, geez, that long tail to low cross sections, you know, how much, what's the chance, right? And I was told at the time that this green blob up here held 98% of the probability density. So I was assured, yeah, if we get down here, we'll see it. And I said this to the particle physicists at the time, it's like, geez, that low probability tail is going to look a lot more probable when you don't see anything at that level. Hello, looking for you. This is the most recent constraint from us.
Oh, great.
Chopped off that head. And the theorists are up to their current games. If you go at the present prediction, it's right here. Did we say that? No, we meant this. And this is already a couple years old now, so I'm there should be another update soon. I would think, the problems. But basically, these experiments have been very successful in not seeing anything. Like, you really should have seen something by now. Okay.
That tail goes into the neutrino function.
Yes, the problem is that once you start, once you get away from the natural cross-section, right, that was the compelling part of the WIMP miracle, that the cross-section you needed to get the right mass density was the weak scale, the weak force cross-section, right? Once you abandon that, because the data say you have to, well, you don't have any natural scale anymore, so you can make it anything you want, look up any theory you want. And I started asking them this at the same time. It's like, okay, how low can you go? Well, how far do you want to go? You can have a particle with zero cross-section so that these things will never, ever see them. I would say that it's not a satisfactory theory, but it is a logical possibility. Okay, so those are the WIMPs. The experimental situation is very grim. And grimmer than most people realize or are willing to admit. As we discussed last time, we really should have seen in the LHC some indication of dark matter, or at least of supersymmetry, which is the parent theory for these dark matter particles, at least the ones we've been assuming are the right ones so far. That's pretty much excluded at this point. And you can make more complicated theories, and you can never exclude them. These direct detection experiments like CDMS and LUX that we just talked about have seen nothing so far. Every time there's going to be an announcement from one of them, they keep it secret. There's a whole lot of speculation on the web, and then they say, ta-da! They didn't see anything. There was a fun one back in 2009, 2010, where there was a lot of speculation that CDMS was going to say something, and CDMS came out and said, we found two WIMPs. Two, really two, plus or minus two, but two. And then all these indirect detections, I mean, we're really getting kind of desperate here. There's the gamma ray excess near the galactic center. I showed you last time the picture of what the gamma ray sky should look like if you could image it well enough, and there were WIMPs turning into gamma rays out there. There is an excess background of gamma rays in the direction of the galactic center. Galactic center is a really complicated place. There are a lot of astrophysical sources there. So it's hard to convince yourself that these are not being created by the things that you can see creating them there. On the other hand, people have done this pretty carefully, and it does look like there's another source of gamma rays than the ones that we can readily account for. Really hard to do that. But even if that's true, there's an obvious source, pulsars. Okay. There's actually a separate problem among people who worry about the stellar populations that leave behind the remnants of old stars, that there should be more pulsars in the galactic center than we know about. So they may well have detected an excess. It's not obvious it's anything to do with dark matter. In fact, the spectrum looks like it, what you would predict for pulsars. These cosmic ray excesses we talked about, a lot of people got really excited before they came to their senses. So far, there's no real evidence there. There's been some talk recently about some X-ray lines that are seen in clusters that we haven't been able to identify what atomic transition they correspond to, and so people have built models that produce those, and it just kind of decay again, but they're not WIMPs, they'd have to be something different because the energy scales are all wrong. It's like 3 keV or something rather than 100 GeV. Again, I'd be very surprised if, you know, there are lots of lines in astrophysical sources that we don't understand when we first detect them. Nebulium being the prime example. Did I tell you about Nebulium? So when people first started taking spectra with photographic plates on telescopes in the 19th century, they saw these strong emission lines in nebula. H2 regions, planetary nebula, and so forth. And these did not correspond to any of the lines that were known in the laboratory at the time. So they're like, oh, it's a new substance, nebulium. It's the stuff nebula are made of. And this was done in, I mean, it's not as crazy as it sounds. It's easy to mock, but remember, this was how helium was discovered, right? Astronomers saw these lines in the spectrum of the sun that we didn't know about in the laboratory. It turns out that nebulium is doubly ionized oxygen. At the time, nobody could put oxygen in the lab and ionize it twice and measure its properties. So there's a long history of this, and I'd be very surprised if this did not just have a mundane astrophysical application. But we are so desperate that we're grabbing at these kinds of straws, and there is a community of people who will claim just about any bump in the dark. And they're willing to make up any kind of model to do it. So I have only taught you about WIMPs. You can always make up something. And I am not qualified to tell you what the heck all these models are. You'd have to go talk to our colleagues across the quad. MSSM is the parent model of supersymmetry that seemed reasonable, but even within that there are different ideas. They didn't even bother putting WIMPs on here. There's WIMP plus dark matter. I don't know what that means. There's self-interacting dark matter, which is what James Bullock gave a shout out to for yesterday. His pet crazy model, which is wiser than me and doesn't talk too much about it, but it does have some appealing features. But as we discussed earlier, that's where the WIMPs can actually scatter off of each other. But again, you need to make up a new force in the dark sector, which transmits the force between. So it's not simple. And there's that force carrier, the dark photon. I did not make that up. Sterile neutrinos, those might actually exist, but whether they're relevant to this problem is harder to say. Warm dark matter is just something we cooked up to be just right. On the one hand, this is tremendously exciting and there's lots of parameter space to explore. On the other hand, there's a tremendous amount of parameter space to explore. It really feels to me like adding episodes. That's what really disturbs me about it, is that we're just making stuff up. And a lot of times we're making stuff up that we can't test. So I am famous for doubting all of this, and so I at least want to give you an overview of why. And I was convinced of the picture I have expressed skepticism about before I became skeptical about it. And the danger
is that we think we know too much, and that's what gets us into trouble, is when we're very sure that something has to be true, and it's not. Politically, climate change is an example. Nope, we are not responsible for climate change, there's nothing we can do about it. If that turns out not to be true, then we've made a big mistake. So, I have taught you the things we know for sure. Newton taught us the Poisson equation. That's not the Newton equation, is it? It took a while to work out the math and so forth. So, these things take time, and we're living in an epoch where we're still trying to figure this stuff out. He did tell us the second law, and it leads to B squared equals gm over r, which is the one equation you really need to remember to get through the final. But we've used this to fill the universe with non-baryonic cold dark matter, right? New form, entirely new form of particle that has no place in the standard model of particle physics. That's a major leap in a lot of new physics. So I got worried about this because of astronomical data. Looking at the Tolle-Fisher relation again, I trust you remember Tolle-Fisher. Originally, it was known for high surface brightness galaxies, so these are the highest surface brightness galaxies. And if you just think this through, v squared goes as gm over r. I made you do this on a homework, so hopefully you remember. One way to get to this is to square that, and then you recognize v4th goes as a constant times the mass times the surface density. And if all galaxies had the same surface brightness, then they'd all fall on the same relation. That was the standard interpretation of the Tolle-Fisher relation when I was young. But it has this term, this only works if this is constant, and so I was working on galaxies that by construction had different surface brightnesses. And so I predicted, this was my prediction, based on this reasoning, that if you went to lower surface brightnesses, you would fall off, and that's the amount by which you should fall off. More and more as you went to lower and lower surface brightnesses, and the data did not cooperate. So this was really very confusing, and I still struggle to understand this in a conventional way. You can rephrase this as in terms of the residuals. So this is the deviation from the best fit Tolle-Fisher relation as a function of deviations in size. So if you plot up the size of galaxies against their rotation speed or mass or whatever, there is a relation. Bigger galaxies are more massive. But there's a huge amount of scatter. Right? So it's not just v squared equals gm over r, say, because that would mean that you can fit a relation here, look at the residuals and size at a given mass, that's what you're seeing here, and derive that you would expect that slope of minus 1/2. You do not see that. Okay. Now, this is what disturbs me, and which maybe I am wrong about, and maybe my colleagues are wrong about, but this is where we argue a lot. So you should go away and think about this on your own. Now what is true, I don't think anybody will argue, is that Newton says this. Right? The mass here is the dynamical mass. It is the sum of baryons, stars and gas, and dark matter enclosed by that radius r. So you can rewrite this in terms of those surface distances. M over r squared, but there's a component due to the normal stuff, there's a component due to the dark matter. And in this previous argument that I just made, what we need is to keep the total mass surface density constant. So either there's a fine tuning, right, you need to keep that sum constant, or you need this number to always be smaller than that number. So this is the newer standard interpretation. That all galaxies are dark matter dominated, so this always exceeds that enough that you can just strike that out, and it's practically a constant surface. So even though you're looking at galaxies of different surface brightness, that's just the stars don't matter, it's just the dark matter. But, as we've talked in the past in the course, that the baryons do matter. One way to see this is just to go and measure the dynamical acceleration at some point. So this is the peak in the rotation curve. Remember, you calculated what that was for an exponential disk. So for every rotation curve, something like that, that's what we actually observe. What it predicts for us does something like this. The argument I just made is that this always has to be way low. In order for sigma dark matter to really be much greater than sigma baryon, we need the disks to be doing something like that. But never mind that. You can identify this radius and go measure the actual velocity at that peak radius where the baryons are supposed to contribute as much as they're going to contribute. And so that's what's plotted here. This is the dynamical acceleration at that point as a function of the baryonic surface density, just the stuff we can see. Okay. Now, if the story we just made up, that the dark matter always dominated this, I would not expect to see a correlation here. Instead, there's a really strong correlation that the actual dynamical acceleration, which we're attributing entirely to dark matter, correlates well with the surface density that we see in baryons. Strikes me as a straight up contradiction. But this is the part you all need to think about yourself. Don't take my word for it, and don't take cosmologists' word for it, because they have to take some time to rub two brain cells together about this, because they already know the answer. That's what gets them into trouble. Now, it's not the, there is a relation, but it's not the relation that Newton predicts. Right? So, if this were just Newton with no dark matter, no funny gravity, no nothing, then you would get a straight line here. It's not that. It's got a different slope, and it's about a slope and a half. So we have this kind of contradictory situation. The lack of residuals in Tully-Fisher, on the one hand, tell us that the baryons don't matter. This correlation tells us that the baryons do matter. You can always balance this out if you're willing to fine-tune, right? But you always, I think the way to think of it is whatever you have for baryons and able to, in order not for them to push this up, right, as you increase the disk mass, you think this would go up. As that happens, you have to take out some of the dark matter, and you have to keep that exactly balanced. All right, so always on the tree, there has been this other branch. We've spent the entire semester talking about this side of the tree, and so now we have 10 minutes to talk about that. And it's not, you know, it's not entirely flippant, because I have had reports of former students going out and talking to people, and the first thing they ask them is, has Stacy indoctrinated you? I hope I have not done that. I really try very hard to talk about everything that we know along the way. So there are real problems. And there are real problems with this that we certainly won't get to in 2 minutes, but I do want to outline what's going on. Now, you can make a length gear. The idea of modified gravity rather than dark matter is hardly new. People thought of this early on and tried to write down theories. And the most obvious thing to do right now, if you want to change the Porsche law rather than invoke dark matter, is say, geez, maybe things change on some length scale, larger than our diameter, let's say, what that is. And galaxies are much, much bigger than the solar system, right? So in the solar system, we have that the force per unit mass acceleration is what Newton told us over there for a reason. Gm over r squared is the acceleration. But let's suppose that this becomes 1 over r for these large rate values, right? So this ends up looking like gm over little r is the actual variable, r dagger is this magic length scale. And if that length scale is a few kiloparsecs, then it's much bigger than the solar system. The solar system will behave entirely in a Newtonian way. But the galaxy is that big or bigger, so you'll see that.
Now, look at what this does. The acceleration that you need to keep the stars in their orbit is still centrifugal. Squared over R. The little R's cancel out now. You have a term that's a constant, Newton's constant, and this new scale that you've introduced in your force law, times the mass, this is good. It makes rotation curves flat. Once you get beyond our dagger, right? That's what we want, flat rotation curves. What else do we need? This is predicting a Tolle-Fisher relation of the form that goes as b squared. That is the wrong slope. So that does not work. Throw away any modification that does that right away. And this is another way of seeing it. This is the radius. Cuts off here. This is the radius where the dark matter outweighs the luminous matter by a factor of 2. So you just go along the rotation curve and ask where you've gotten more dark matter than normal matter. And it's all over the place, right? Really bright galaxies, you can get out many tens of kiloparsecs before you have that much dark matter. Smaller galaxies, though, you need dark matter almost right away. These are just upper limits on that. Right? So there is no universal size scale. There is no R dagger that works for all the galaxies. So again, you can just throw away those ideas right away. And people tried them, found they didn't work, and so they said, okay, it's got to be dark matter. But there is a scale that matters. So here's the amplitude of the mass discrepancy, how much dark matter you need over how much stuff you see, as a function of different things. So size, they're all over the place. Frequency, it's still a mess. Turns out that acceleration is the critical thing. That was what we saw already in the global sense by plotting the acceleration at the one point function of the characteristic baryonic surface density. That was a global measurement. These are local measurements at every point along all the rotation curves that you get together. So there is a good correlation in that regard. And so it turns out that the only theory that does this is this crazy, it's really the most unlikely of theories introduced by Milgram a long time ago now. And the remarkable thing to me is that it comes anywhere close. As we just saw, you can't just do something and have it work out, right? You can make flat rotation curves, but it gives you the wrong Tolle-Fisher slope in the way I just described. Mond is the theory that actually seems to work. What time do I have? Not much. So the idea here is that above, there is a new scale, but rather than a length scale, it's an acceleration scale. A-naught. A-naught is of order 10 to the minus 10 meters per second per second. That is one part in 10 to the 11 of what we feel here in this room. This only happens in this regime of tiny accelerations, but that's the centrifugal acceleration that stars feel that hold them in their orbits around galaxies. So above that scale, everything is normal. The acceleration is just what Newton tells you is. So g sub n is the Newtonian calculation that you get from what's on the plane, well, for the Poisson equation. In this modified regime, and this is the crazy brilliant part, it is both crazy and brilliant, is that in the modified regime, you don't just transition to something completely different. You multiply what Newton predicts in quadrature with this constant, you know. And this is what drives theorists crazy, because you know you could have a transition to a completely different force, like 1 over r, but this isn't just 1 over r, it's square root of m over r. That's just really weird, theoretically. Now, it does have some nice theoretical things, but another really awkward part of the theory is that you just paste these two regimes together with some interpolation. Now, when Milgram first wrote this down, he did some very simple calculations. This does not conserve energy or momentum. That's bad. So again, you can throw that theory away, right? Well, he knew that, so he worked on it a little more, and within the year, he came up with this modified version of the Poisson equation, which I will write down because it's not quite visible there. Now remember, the normal Poisson equation is just this. Modified version has the interpolation function in it. And remember, the derivative of the gravitational potential is an acceleration. So this is an example of modified gravity. Bekenstein is the one who came up with this, Milgram, but they worked together on it. And this is also called an aquadratic Lagrangian. But the important part of that is not that it's aquadratic, it's that it's derivable from a Lagrangian. And a theory that you can derive from a Lagrangian by construction conserves energy and momentum. So the first thing that Milgram wrote down was crazy, and you could throw it away. But with a little thought, you could construct a theory that does the right thing. And that's more or less where we are today, is that we've been able to modify Newton in a way that fits a lot of data that I don't have time to tell you about today. But it's only a modification of Newton, not a modification of general relativity. And that piece is really hard, if it's possible at all. You can modify gravity. This changes the force of the force law. All right, that's what's different. You could also modify inertia in this low acceleration regime. Which sounds even more crazy because you're basically saying F equals ma is no longer true at very low accelerations. But if you look at these equations, one of the fundamentally strange things is that the inertial mass equals the gravitational charge. That's not true in any other force law, right? Charge in E&M behaves just like this, but it's the inertial mass that is how something responds. So electrons and protons exert equal charges on each other, but they don't move in the same way because protons are a lot more massive. In gravity, mass and charge are the same thing, and that is a fundamental thing we do not understand. Just do not get it. So, all right, so I've already run over time, so I will stop there. I will try to cram everything in next time. But your homeworks are due then anyway, so you have to show up. Right. Any questions?